This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new book describes a period when the press was partisan and at times vile, crude, unjust, and more likely to incite than inform. The period being described here? Colonial America. My guest, Eric Burns, is the author of the new book, Infamous Scribblers, The Founding Fathers and the Rowdy Beginnings of American Journalism. It covers the period just before and after the Revolutionary War. Among the people Burns writes about are Founding Fathers Ben Franklin and Sam Adams, who are also publishers. Burns is the host of Fox News Watch, the Fox News Channel's weekly roundtable of media criticism featuring a panel of liberals and conservatives. Burns is also a former NBC News correspondent. He won an Emmy Award for media criticism. In his book, Infamous Scribblers, Burns writes that the golden age of America's founding was also the gutter age of American journalism. Here's an example.
Samuel Adams, who makes a much better brand of beer than he did a brand of journalism, Samuel Adams so wanted to incite his fellow Bostonians and countrymen to revolution, to independence, that he wrote, Terry, fiction. He would write articles about soldiers who were on patrol in Boston, for instance, assaulting women on the streets. Incidents that never happened. He encouraged, once the Stamp Act was passed, encouraged in an article violence against a man named Andrew Oliver, whose charge it was to collect the Stamp Act taxes. Not only that, but after he wrote the article, and I'm not sure exactly what the article said, but I know one of the things he suggested was that Oliver be hanged in effigy. That night, he gathered some of his friends who were known to fellow patriots as the Sons of Liberty and known to the British by far more derogatory terms. He gathered them together and he told them how to take matters into their own hands. His article, in other words, wasn't enough in terms of being incendiary. He said, listen, fellas, go to Oliver's house, throw bricks and stones and rocks through the windows, trash the guy's house. And when you see him, tell him there will be a lot more in store for him if he doesn't resign his position. This was done. Oliver resigned his position.
Did this change your impression of Samuel Adams?
Tremendously. I read several biographies of Sam Adams, and he was a journalist longer than he was anything else. I mean, he was also the governor of Massachusetts for a while, and he did a lot of really admirable things. But the people who write the overarching biographies, as opposed to what I did, which is to say, look at Adams simply through the prism of his journalistic practices, tend to dismiss his journalism in just a few phrases by saying that he was rebellious. He tried to stir the colonists to independence. He might not have been the most factual fellow, but his heart was in the right place, that kind of thing. And that is, in fact, the reason that he has been not just forgiven but exalted by history. He was thoroughly disreputable as a journalist in the most noble of causes. And so when we look at the whole man, as most biographers of Adams do, we conclude that he did the right thing. It's a question of means and ends, and this is a case of the ends justifying the means in the case of most historians and biographers.
I think we'd like to think that journalistic ethics does not forgive making up lies for a just cause.
Well, journalistic ethics don't. But when you write a biography of someone like Sam Adams, you make journalistic ethics simply one category. And, you know, to me, Terry, that was the really interesting thing about writing this book. If you write, let's say, a biography of Thomas Jefferson, it's like standing in front of Jefferson and seeing him from head to toe. It's a look at the whole man. But when you do what I did, which is examine Jefferson and various other founders just in terms of how they reacted to and how they were part of the world of journalism, it's like bringing him very close to you and then putting a magnifying glass under a small part of him. It's not an accurate total picture of the person, but it's a fascinating view of one part of that person.
Okay, you mentioned Jefferson. What's his connection to the press?
When Jefferson served in the Washington administration, he was the Secretary of State. He would take State Department money and use it to fund a newspaper called the National Gazette, which trashed the policies of the administration, the Washington administration, in which he served. Government money going against government policy. And not only that, Terry, what he would do is occasionally he would leave his office door, the door to the State Department, unlocked at night. He would leave papers on his desk which, either in and of themselves or quoted out of context, would make the Washington administration look bad. And the editor of the National Gazette, the most famous poet of the time, Philip Freneau, would come in at night, sneak these papers out, put them in the National Gazette, and when Washington at some point later on wondered about this and said to Jefferson, "Is there anything we can do to get the National Gazette to tone it down?" Jefferson said, "Well, I'll try, but I don't really know Freneau that well, and I don't really have much of a connection with the paper." He was telling a lie, and he was being, in his own way, as unethical as Sam Adams had been for his cause.
So Jefferson was not only a founding father, he was a founding leaker, one of the first leakers in America.
Actually, you know, historians say that the leak was invented by George Washington and that it was done with all the sophistication of a modern president leaking. Washington, I think, Terry, was the greatest victim of the American press ever to sit in the White House. He did not, of course, sit in the White House. We didn't have a White House then. But to try to control, damage control is the phrase we would use today, it was Washington who first came up with the idea of the journalistic leak and had his cabinet officers take people out, buy him a beer or two, and say, "Listen, here's some information just for you."
You brought up Washington, and how he was handled in the press is a good example of how partisan the press was back in early American history. There was a campaign in a paper called The Aurora, which was published by Ben Franklin's grandson,
right,
to force Washington out of office.
I don't know to
retire immediately.
Yeah, I don't know that it was necessarily a campaign. It might, Terry, have been the whole reason that the paper existed. But one of the articles that wanted Washington out of the office, in fact, began with the phrase you just mentioned, "retire immediately," and then it went on as follows: "Let no flatterer persuade you to rest 1 hour longer at the helm of state. You are utterly incapable to steer the political ship into the harbor of safety. If you have any love for your country, leave its affairs to the wisdom of your fellow citizens. Do not flatter yourself with the idea that you know their interests better than other men. There are thousands amongst them who equal you in capacity and who excel you in knowledge." Terry, this was not an editorial. There were no editorials at the time. This was simply an article in an American newspaper of the colonial period.
We said it was, in a way, the function of that paper, The Aurora, to get Washington out of office. How was the paper founded by Ben Franklin's grandson?
How was it founded?
Yeah, I mean, did he actually create it with the purpose of getting Washington out of office?
He created it with the purpose of getting federalism to be discredited, because once Washington was out of office, the paper continued to exist for a while, although Benjamin Franklin Bache died at the age of 29, so it didn't last terribly long. But he was just as vicious with Adams, who was also a federalist.
We're talking about how partisan the press was in colonial times and in the early United States, and how some things were just made up. There's a paper called The Wasp. This was a small paper in Hudson, New York. And on the masthead, where the New York Times, for instance, has all the news that's fit to print, the Wasp had, "To lash the rascals naked through the word." It's just like, what a motto. What was that paper like?
That paper was like the motto would suggest. To me, the really salient point here is why were papers like this at a time when such intellectual giants strode the earth? The two problems with the press then, and why I think they existed: unfairness and viciousness. Papers were unfair at the time, most simply put, Terry, because there was no tradition of fairness. If you owned a press, you were a businessman, and for someone to ask you to be fair would be to ask you to include points of view other than your own, which would be to ask you, in effect, to advertise your competitors. That's how people looked at it back then. And with no tradition of fairness to call on, the printer of a paper would say, why should I? I mean, it would be like a blacksmith saying, well, sure, I can shoe your horse, but if you take it down the street, the guy will do it more quickly and more cheaply. It wasn't going to happen. Why was it so vicious? I believe that the two most important events in American history, and I would rank the Civil War third, happened during this era. First, of course, was the Revolutionary War, and second was the battle to interpret the Constitution, which is to say to decide what kind of country the Revolutionary War was going to produce. With events of this magnitude following one upon the other, I think that even the noblest of people felt this. There is simply too much at stake these days for civility. And I think these are the reasons that the press at this time was what it was like.
And you're making it sound like publishers saw their papers as just mouthpieces and megaphones for their views.
They did. They did. Fairness didn't really come into the press, and I don't even get into this in the book because I'm talking about colonial times. But the single most important event in making the press fair, Terry, didn't happen until after the Civil War, when wire services started. The Telegraph allowed the Associated Press to come into existence, and the Associated Press simply didn't have time to come up with several different versions of one story, you know, the right-wing version, the left-wing version, the sensational version, the restrained version. Fairness came about because the Associated Press really had time in conveying all the news to all its subscriber papers just to write one version. So they tried to be as middle of the road as they could. But before that, few people saw the reason for a newspaper to be fair because the guy who owned it would have been working against his own ideological interests if he were fair.
Was there anything that could be called independent journalism back in the early period of American history? You know, you've got publishers, but you've got publishers using newspapers as a mouthpiece. Are there reporters? Are there reporters who have, you know, who actually go out and just report accurately on what they're seeing?
Actually, Terry, there weren't even reporters until probably, certainly not in any great numbers, until after the war. The way the Revolutionary War was covered, for instance, is quite instructive. I know of one man, the publisher of the Massachusetts Spy, who went out and covered a couple of stories himself. But by and large, the Revolutionary War was covered through the mail. That is to say, soldiers would send letters back home to loved ones, and those would be given to newspapers. Sometimes letters would be written specifically to newspapers. But there were no such things as reporting staffs. By and large, the printer stayed in his shop and hoped that someone would come in with some information. In terms of independent journalism, if by that you mean journalism that was unbiased, no, I encountered none of it. Now, I did encounter some professions of it, which is to say there were a few papers at the time which claimed that they were beholden to no one, that they would print the truth as they saw it, but they almost always saw it through one particular set of lenses.
Now, one of the things I find interesting about your show is that the two liberals and the two conservatives with you as moderator usually have a pretty civil conversation with each other and even laugh at each other's jokes, assuming there's any wit behind the jokes.
Wait a minute. Are you criticizing the jokes that we write and saying that they don't work?
That was the main point of the question. No, but but I mean, it's and sometimes people surprise you, and you know, a liberal and a conservative on the show will agree with each other instead of arguing with each other. Do you feel like on a lot of shows that liberals and conservatives are almost playing a part in a play that's already been written, and that it's their job to represent the official conservative or the official liberal point of view and to never waver from what that official position is to be and to never think that an issue is ambiguous?
Without question. On most shows, they're like a repertory company. They know their roles. The dialogue changes because the issues change, but they know who they're supposed to be. I as far as I'm concerned, and you may either back me up, criticize me, or move on to another topic, but I don't think that happens on Fox News Watch. Every possible pairing you could imagine has taken place at some point on that show. Gabler, the self-described progressive, agreeing with Thomas, the family values conservative. I mean, there are some issues that bring everybody together, it seems to me, because it's not just a matter of addressing political bias on the show, which frankly I find a little tedious and predictable occasionally. There are far bigger problems with the media today than political bias, because political bias, it seems to me, Terry, is a pretty easy thing to identify. But sensationalism, misplaced priorities, laziness, stories that should be covered and that are not covered, just plain accuracy, these to me are much more important issues than, you know, whether President Bush was traduced by this paper, or whether John Kerry during the election got an unfair shake from this paper.
Now, do you identify yourself publicly as liberal or conservative?
No, and I take a great deal of pride in getting emails that I get with some frequency from people who say, "I've been watching your show for years and I have no idea what you are." I have not been hired by Fox to express political views. My own personal feeling is that my political views are A, my own business, and B, not a part of Fox News Watch. There are four people on that show who have been chosen because not just of journalistic expertise, but because they have certain political starting points from which they approach issues. A half-hour program doesn't need a fifth person like that, and I have made it a point, and in fact, I hope I'm not overstating the case, a badge of honor to be unidentified politically. And I hope you don't know what I am. Do you? You watch the show.
Well, I don't. But, you know, I assume a lot of people say to you, "Oh, sure, you don't identify publicly as liberal or conservative, but if Fox hired you, you must be conservative."
Well, there's nothing I can do about that. Neil Gabler is rabidly not conservative. Alan Colmes is. As a matter of fact, I saw an article some time ago about, you know, Fox, I think, has more opinion givers than any other network, and therefore you can put what I'm going to say right now into that context. But Fox has, according to some article I read in one of the broadcast publications, more openly avowed liberals on its payroll as contributors, which is to say, you know, people who are called on from time to time to offer opinions, than any other network.
Do you watch the Daily Show and the Colbert Report? And I wonder how you think they're affecting the news and how people see the news.
Actually, I'm going to be on The Daily Show pretty soon, so I have been studying it more than ever. It's an intriguing show, isn't it? Because the interviews are very often with serious people. I'd like to consider myself one. And the rest of the show isn't serious. I will quote from one of my panelists, Neil Gabler, about The Daily Show, and I think he makes a very perceptive point. It's frightening to think that there might be people who depend on The Daily Show as their sole source of news. That charge is leveled against young people. I don't know how accurate it is. But the point Gabler makes is that what he thinks is so valuable about The Daily Show, and I agree, is, and this is his phrase, The Daily Show gets it. A conventional newscast is supposed to be objective. It just doesn't I'm looking for a phrase other than cut through the BS, because I would like to say something a little more eloquent than that, but nothing comes to mind. That's what that show does. That show, it seems to me, tells you the truth in a manner not only humorous, but if you analyze it, pretty hard-hitting. It points out the fakery, for instance, of the political statement, the speciousness of certain things that on a regular newscast would be presented without comment, because that's what journalists are supposed to do. So apart from the humor, the service that it performs, I think, is to it just presents truth very often at a deeper level. It doesn't buy the pretense of a lot of, in particular, politicians' statements.
Eric Burns, thank you so much for talking with us.
The pleasure was mine, Terry. Thank you for the invitation.
Eric Burns is the author of Infamous Scribblers, The Founding Fathers and the Rowdy Beginnings of American Journalism. He hosts the media show Fox News Watch on the Fox News Channel.